I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. With atypical public commentary, his calls for tolerance of marginalized groups, and his challenges to capitalism, Pope Francis has been hailed as a reformer, someone who has changed not only the tone, but the culture of the Vatican. On Tuesday, he declared Oscar Romero a martyr for the Catholic faith, lifting a controversial Vatican ban on sainthood for the Salvadoran Archbishop, who was gunned down by right-wing militants 35 years ago. Not everyone is happy with the Pope's actions and remarks. Conservatives have taken issue with his criticisms of capitalism, and others balk at his off-the-cuff style. Observations and commentary about Pope Francis as his second anniversary approaches, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. It was announced this week that Pope Francis is among the nominees for the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize for his commitment to address social justice issues and concerns for the environment. It's been nearly 2 years since Pope Francis took over as head of the Catholic Church, and he's been hailed as a reformer, someone who has already changed the tone and the culture of the Vatican, and someone who embraces technology and bridges relationships between marginalized groups. Today, the Pope hosted his second ever, I didn't know there was a first one, Google Hangout, live from the Vatican. So he's a digital age Pope. And at the beginning of the year, despite the fact that the Catholic Church doesn't recognize sex change procedures as legitimate, a transgender man from Spain had a private audience with the pontiff, reportedly the first time a pope has met with a transgender person. The pope played a role in the recent thaw in Cuban-American relations. On Tuesday of this week, he declared Oscar Romero a martyr for the Catholic faith, lifting a controversial Vatican ban on sainthood for the Salvadoran archbishop, who was gunned down by right-wing militants 35 years ago as he celebrated Mass. Not everyone hails Pope Francis and his style as a move in the right direction. Conservatives have taken issue with his criticisms of capitalism, global income inequality, and trickle-down economics, and others balk at his off-the-cuff remarks to the media. So during this hour of the show, we'll look at Pope Francis. There's a lot to talk about. He makes news just about every day and always has something interesting to say or to present to the world. So this is sort of catch-up with Pope Francis hour here on Midday. And we'd like to hear from you a question I've asked before when we discussed the new pope since he became pope in March of 2013. American Catholics, those of you out there listening to our show, are you encouraged by this? Has the Pope got your attention? If you are a fallen-off Catholic and stopped going to Mass, stop observing, are you observant again? Are you returning to church and to Mass? With me in the studio for another conversation about Pope Francis is Fritz Bauerschmidt. Fritz Bauerschmidt is chairman of the Department of Theology at Loyola University, Maryland. He was with us the last time, the first time we talked about Francis when he became Pope. Fritz Bauerschmidt is also a deacon assigned to Corpus Christi Parish here in Baltimore, and he blogs at Pray Tell Worship, Wit, and Wisdom. Nice to have you back on the show, Fritz. Nice to see you again.
Good to be here.
David Cloutier is back. David is an associate professor of theology at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg. He writes a lot. He's a writer on Catholic affairs, a blogger at Catholic Moral Theology, and has a new book out. David, nice to see you.
Good to see you again, Dan.
You have a new book out. It's very timely because we're going to talk about the Pope and environmental concerns. This book is about the environment and Catholic faith called Walking God's Earth, just published this past fall by Liturgical Press, right?
Thank you.
Nice to have you back, David.
Always good to be here.
And I wanted to say hello again to Joseph or Jeff Goethals.
Goethals.
Goethals. Nice to see you again, Jeff.
Nice to be here.
Jeff Goethals. How do I do Goethals?
Goethals.
Goethals, you prefer.
Yes.
Now, that's because you were born in Belgium.
I'm born in Belgium, yes.
You were a priest. You're a former priest, a retired teacher of Notre Dame Prep.
Yes, that's right.
And the last time you were here was to talk about your excellent book called I Never Left
I really never left.
Your memoir of priesthood and missionary work and school teaching, the whole thing.
That's right, yeah.
And you have a great interest. You came of age during Second Vatican Council.
Yes.
Of course, that's what a lot of your book was about.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be interesting to get your thoughts about Pope Francis as well.
Okay.
Why don't I start with you, in fact?
All right,
Jeff.
No problem.
You know, you were in the studio a couple of years ago. We didn't have Pope Francis to talk about.
No.
So starting from scratch, what do you say about this new Pope?
Well, I tell you, when I heard Francis say "Buonasera,"
yeah,
and then that his name was Francis, and then that he asked the people to pray for him, I knew something was completely different. I had a sigh of relief after 35 years, and I knew that the church was going to be different, and I have not been disappointed. I knew this was going to be, from what I have seen so far, this is the Pope of Vatican II.
Well, what do you mean by that? Explain that for
because
for our
I
listeners.
Think I in my opinion, he is a little at a time implementing Vatican II. Especially I see it, what he is doing with the bishops' conferences. And I think he's going to take the power of Rome and bring it to the dioceses and to the local bishops. And that was one, in my opinion, that is one of the main things of Vatican II. And that has been thwarted in the last two pontificates.
For the person who doesn't understand what that means, those of us who grew up with Vatican II and understand what that means, it means opening windows, opening the doors to the church, just bringing
giving more power to the local church.
So you see him doing that.
I see him doing this.
And Fritz Bauerschmidt, there's a lot of that in what Francis has to say to the clergy, to bishops and to priests.
Oh, certainly. And I mean, I think some of it grows out of Francis's own experience. I mean, he was the bishop of a diocese that was very far from Rome in Argentina. And as opposed to Pope Benedict, who spent, you know, much of his life in working in the Vatican. So I think that's just a kind of a change of perspective. And I think Francis probably has a more instinctive understanding of what the life in churches that are very far from Rome is like. So I think that's another factor here.
David Cloutier, we've heard those admonitions or admonishments from the Pope to bishops and priests to serve their flocks, to, you know, get out of the rectory, basically, right?
One of his important themes has been this concept of spiritual worldliness. He constantly warns both Vatican officials and bishops not to fall into this temptation of spiritual worldliness, this idea that their office is some kind of worldly power or gives them some kind of privilege. This is part of the reason he isn't big on ceremony, on fancy dress, but he also feels that people need to go out among the people, right?
One of his good lines, I know it's good because he uses it a lot, is that the shepherd should smell like the sheep,
right?
And I think he embodies that, and I think people sense that, and I think one reason. I mean, you mentioned his meeting with the transgender person.
From Spain, yeah.
And I suspect he's not just the first pope that a transgender person would meet with a transgender person, but he might be the first pope that a transgender person would want to meet with.
Yeah.
Because while I'm not in a position to judge how sympathetic or unsympathetic prior popes would have been, but Francis can somehow communicate that sense that he's approachable and that he's somebody who will listen to people's experience and he'll take that in.
There is one thing I would like to add. When I look at Pope Francis, I look at a prophet and think of the prophets of the Old Testament. The prophets of the Old Testament made us feel uncomfortable. They jerked us around. And that's what he is doing, in a sense.
He's challenging. He's challenging almost everybody.
It seems
in some way.
Jesus, yeah. He flipped the tables at the temple. And Francis is flipping a lot of tables.
In particular, I'm struck by how frequently he has spoken out about the flaws in capitalism, income inequality, global inequality, economic inequality, the need to do something about that. I mean, we've heard popes talk about the need to attend to the poor, right? In the past. This is different.
Well, as with many things, it's not the content of Francis's message that's new. It's the way he can deliver the message. And I think this does go back to another thing Fritz mentioned, that he has lived with the poor. He has not worked in offices or in privileged European positions for most of his life. So it's not an abstract problem to him. Rather, it's a concrete problem on the ground. And I think that that comes through in the passion that he's able to communicate, even though he's not any more critical of capitalism than John Paul II and Benedict were. They both were severely critical of capitalism. But Francis kind of knows what he's talking about in a visceral way. He can smell the sheep who are oppressed by capitalism.
But also, he does not, you know, he has not made any infallible statements about capitalism, but he makes fallible statements that shakes everybody up.
Yeah. I would say the other thing that distinguishes him here in this regard, on this subject, Fritz, see if you agree with me, is the timing of it. There's a lot of talk about income inequality in this country and around the world. So, yes, maybe John Paul, maybe Benedict spoke about it, but there's a lot of other, Thomas Piketty, and his book on capital, mm-hmm. and Francis, you put the two of them together and you have a global conversation going.
Right. I mean, I think Francis has got excellent timing on a number of, yeah. of issues.
Yeah. Timing.
His timing is impeccable. Maybe it was all those years dancing the tango down in Argentina. I don't know. But it's also, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting, and I've been reading some on this just recently, is we have a tendency to always immediately want to put anything in the church into sort of our normal political categories. And I think this is true on the left or on the right. I mean, you know, Sarah Palin's remark after Francis's apostolic letter, wow, that sounds kind of liberal. Or
even
Rush
Marxist.
Limbaugh.
Did he say Marxist?
Saying this is, Rush socialist? Limbaugh said this is pure Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, Francis is coming from a very different context. I mean, he was a Peronist in Argentina. Now, if anybody in North America can tell me what it means to be a Peronist, I mean, I will give them $20. It seems to combine a certain kind of populist traditionalism with
dictatorship,
with you know, an authoritarian regime.
Yeah.
Sometimes seeming to skew to the left, sometimes seeming to skew to the right.
Right.
I mean, so.
Right.
If you can understand Juan Perón, maybe you can understand Pope Francis. I don't know.
Let's talk a little bit about symbols here. I mentioned the Romero announcement this week. Oscar Romero, who was killed, murdered by a death squad in El Salvador, March 1980, as he celebrated Mass, Archbishop, and the Salvadorian Archbishop. Okay, so Francis announces martyrdom for this slain archbishop from 35 years ago. What's the significance of this, David Cloutier? Let's give folks a little bit of the history here.
Well, it's the first step on the way to canonization for Archbishop Romero, and Archbishop Romero is probably the most visible figure of the Latin American liberation theology movement. His martyrdom was, of course, made into a very famous film that is kind of a Catholic staple. And his cause has always been somewhat controversial because of different views about how closely he was associated with various political parties in El Salvador. But unambiguously, Francis is clearly making the statement here that Romero, whatever his particular views about liberation theology at the time, is clearly worthy of veneration.
I suspect in Francis's mind, what's most significant about Romero is not a particular political ideology, but that for Francis, this is the kind of bishop that the church needs. This is a bishop who is a man of the people.
Yeah.
This is a bishop who goes out among the people. This is a bishop who risks his life for the sake of his flock. And I think that that's the really strong message that Francis is sending.
You know, someone listening to David's description of Romero and your comments, Fritz, would say, why was there a holdup in beatification of Oscar Romero? 35 years is not enough time gone by. That's not the issue. The issue has to do with this. Was he practicing liberation theology, right? Or was he speaking in defense of the faith? That's where the split was.
Yeah, I think part of what happened is in the last few decades, a number of bishops from Central America and other parts of Latin America became very powerful in the Vatican. And some of those saw Romero as an extremely divisive figure. You know, whereas we might see him as a champion for the poor, they saw him as the enemy of an upper class that had always been very supportive of the church, partly because the church was very supportive of them. So one of the things that really put Romero on the map was when one of the priests of his diocese, I believe it's Rutilio Grande, was murdered by a death squad. Romero canceled all of the masses in the Diocese of San Salvador and had one Sunday mass at the cathedral that was the funeral mass for this slain priest, as sending the message, if you want to come to mass this Sunday, you're going to come and honor this priest. Well, you can imagine, you know, the ruling class in El Salvador was not very happy about that. So they saw Romero as an extremely divisive figure. And I think a number of the bishops saw him as an extremely divisive figure. He was stirring up trouble. He was, as Jeff said, he's like the prophets. He's making us uncomfortable. He's causing more strife and conflict.
And so declaring martyrdom for him, and the Pope puts him on the road toward sainthood, right?
Yeah.
So he's saying, this is the kind of priest, this is the kind of bishop, archbishop I want, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with Fritz on that. And what is important, whatever the political or the theological reasons are for this, or reasons for not making him a saint earlier, he died for his faith. And to me, personally, it's very, very important, because I had two students when I was a professor in the Philippines in the seminary who were shot just like Romero in Guatemala. And I feel Romero now joins them.
Thank you, Jeff. We're going to take a break here. Listen, we welcome phone calls during this hour of the show. If you have questions or comments about Pope Francis, certainly probably the most interesting man in the world. When I feed the poor, they call me a saint. But when I ask why the poor are hungry, they call me a communist. A great quote I wanted to share today of a story that we posted to my Facebook page about the Pope's declaration that Oscar Romero, Archbishop Romero, it was a martyr for the faith. And that's a quote there from a Brazilian archbishop noting how, you know, the work of the clergy can be construed different ways. When I feed the poor, they call me a saint. But when I ask why the poor are hungry, they call me a communist. Some think that Pope Francis is a communist or a Marxist. He's received that label. What do you think? 410-662-8780. This is Midday. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Our phone number is 410-662-8780. If you'd like to compare notes with our guests on Pope Francis, our guests are Fritz Bauerschmidt, who's chair of the Department of Theology at Loyola University, Maryland, David Cloutier, theologist, associate professor of theology at Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg. Well, David, we'll get a chance to talk about your new book, too, during this hour. And Jeff Gutals is with us in the studio. former teacher at Notre Dame Prep, 32 years at Notre Dame Prep.
Yes, sir.
And a former priest. He actually, your first book was I Really Never Left.
I Really Never Left.
Right,
yeah.
Meaning you really never left the church.
That's right.
And now you have a novel called Holy White Smoke, The Second Vatican Council Under Siege. Could you just briefly tell us what the novel is about?
Okay, it plays in the future in 2032-33. And it's really a cardinal who becomes pope, and right after he is pope, he abrogates Vatican II, which creates,
meaning he
abrogates the documents of Vatican II.
Yeah,
they are invalid.
Oh, okay.
And
that's the basis of your novel.
That's the basis of the novel, and then we get a situation in the church which is reminiscent of the popes of Avignon and the Great Schism. And that's really the gist of my book. But what I wanted to do in the book is talk about Vatican II in the form of a novel. And
okay.
That's what I did.
All right, Jeff. That book, again, is called Holy White Smoke?
Holy White Smoke.
Hey, can I throw here's a Pope story I just want to throw in here from the other day. Pope Francis has said he is truly sorry for offending large Catholic families by saying that there was no need to breed, quote, like rabbits. Okay. I mean, you know, let me finish reading it. So in case you haven't heard this story, the Pope caused dismay among larger families last month when he cautioned responsible parenthood, advising that three children was about right. And a Vatican spokesperson apologized on the Pope's behalf by saying the Pope is truly sorry that his remarks about large families caused such disorientation. Francis caused dismay because of this, of what he said in saying three was about right. So it's off-the-cuff remark, probably, right?
Yeah.
My impression is he talks as Pope. He speaks as Pope the way he spoke when he was back in,
human being.
In South America.
When I heard that story, I thought about the number of times I've been in church where excellent pastors have said something during a homily they're giving or during the announcements where you're like, oh, that's gonna be taken the wrong way.
Right.
And he feels that he can do this as Pope. I think it's very genuine. It can be dangerous sometimes.
Yeah.
He is powerful.
A question from one of our listeners on liberation theology. We go back to that for a minute just to maybe explain a little bit more about that and why that does not go over so well in the Vatican, or at least didn't previously?
Well, liberation theology was a movement starting in the 1960s in Latin America that attempted to link the gospel and Catholic faith more closely with social justice in societies where there was radical income inequality, much more than we experience here in America. And for some liberation theologians, Marxism was a mandate of the gospel. That is, they understood the gospel to be directing people towards socialism and Marxism as the policies that should be advocated. And it was that application that was particularly controversial.
Right. Now, Pope Francis has a rather complicated relationship to liberation theology. When he was the provincial of the Jesuits in Argentina, meaning the head of the Jesuit order in that part of the world. And then afterwards, when he stepped down from that role and was in charge of the seminary that the Jesuits went to in Buenos Aires, he was seen by some as an enemy of liberation theology. But what he seems to have opposed was a form of liberation theology that was too theoretically committed to Marxism and did not have enough contact with the actual lives of the poor. Right. I know that many people that I knew, many Jesuits who I knew, when he was announced as Pope, their reaction was actually, uh-oh. This is this conservative that we've heard about down in Argentina who wants to reject Vatican II, wants to turn back the clock. I think it really had a lot more to do with different approaches to liberation theology.
Right.
Do you begin with Marx and then see Christianity as providing a vehicle for realizing, say, a classless society? Or do you begin with the gospel and the call of the gospel? And you might make common cause with a Marxist if he seems to be pursuing your same ends, but you don't hitch your wagon to him. And Pope Francis, back when he was Jorge Bergoglio, was very clearly of the latter sort.
Jeff?
I just want to make put something in perspective here, that the liberation theology might have been revolutionary. But I think if you compare it, or if you set it in the context of the social encyclicals of the popes were as revolutionary as the liberation theology. So it is just one step in that, in my opinion, in that whole development of the church, its consciousness of the for
David?
Caring for the poor.
The controversy about liberation theology was never a controversy over social justice. Everyone agreed that the church was committed to social justice.
At least in theory.
At least in theory. But it was a controversy over...
The root of it, as Marx explained?
It was a controversy over Marxism as a vehicle for social justice, right?
I agree with that.
Yeah. Let's take a phone call. Mary's giving us a ring here on Midday. Welcome to our show, Mary. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'd like to say thank you for having me. And I was raised here in Baltimore. I went to attend Catholic school from kindergarten to 12th grade, and I am so happy that Pope Francis is our current pope. Excuse me. I'm actually getting teary about it. It's kind of crazy. But as somebody,
he has that effect on people.
He does. And, you know, as somebody that has stood at the gates of Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia, with Father Roy Bourgeois, the leader of the School of the Americas Watch, who has been speaking up against the school that has trained a lot of the assassins, two of which who were involved in the slaying of Archbishop Oscar Romero. I'm so thankful that the Pope has spoken out and has acknowledged Oscar Romero as martyr for the Catholic faith.
Thank you very much. Well, he certainly has made conservatives uncomfortable with his statements about capitalism, the ones we talked about earlier. I think he does with this gesture too, right?
I think so. I think it's a question of how that's going to be interpreted. I think they're more nervous about the environment encyclical that's going to be coming out later this year and about the kinds of convictions that it might stake the church to.
Interesting piece in the New York Times about how the Pope is going over in Congress, you know, conservatives in Congress are used to Catholics, or if there are Catholics or non-Catholics, are used to a pope speaking out against abortion and maybe calling for mercy for the poor or feeding the poor, right? Not specifically pointing to the flaws in capitalism or calling for an embrace of, the climate change is a real thing to be dealt with.
We should be clear that conservatives, although they don't always say this very loud, all agree that we should help the poor. They just think the way to help the poor is free markets as opposed to various other kinds of strategies. But many of them deny the significance of climate change. And the encyclical is likely to state very clearly that while policy details of how to address climate change might differ, that the church thinks that climate change is real and that they're staked to taking stands to change things.
Well, he's taking initiatives to try to influence this Paris conference, right?
Right.
It's coming up. Okay, right. So this encyclical that you're talking about on the environment is highly anticipated. It's what's supposed to be out this summer sometime?
This summer.
Not for a few months.
Of course, it is running on Vatican time, so who knows when it'll actually appear.
Okay. Tell us, why do you see this as so important?
Well, this is the first encyclical that's going to specifically address the issue of the environment. Encyclicals are the most important form of papal teaching. And while the environment has been addressed in encyclicals by John Paul II and especially Benedict, they have never devoted an entire encyclical to it. And given the importance of the global discussion about climate change, especially the concern that poor countries have about climate change, this is probably going to be an encyclical where the Vatican comes down very strongly on one side of a very important global debate that many in the United States are on the other side of.
Yeah, I also think that as he typically does, I think Francis is probably going to shake things up a little bit, and I think he might be a really important voice to introduce into the debate on climate change and the environment in general. I suspect there'll be some recognition of the fact that concern about the environment is a bit of a bourgeois luxury for those of us who already have our well-developed society. But if you're talking about the developing world and you tell them, well, you have to cut back carbon emissions, you can't have so many cars, they're like, wait, we need cars if we're ever going to get our economy going.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that Francis will very much bring that more complex perspective of we need to do something to care for the environment. We need to do things about climate change, but we can't do it on the backs of the poor nations of the world.
Could you explain for me what the basis is for the Pope, any religious leader speaking out about this? But let's talk about the Pope and the Catholic Church. Is there, I mean, I understand this is the historic nature of this encyclical, and it's the historic nature of climate change, but what's the backdrop of that there? Some people may wonder, the Pope, climate change, what do I care what the Pope thinks about climate change?
I would say there are two basic themes that are unlikely to be stressed in the encyclical. One is God as the author of creation, the idea that God has ordered the world in a certain kind of way and that humans have to respect that order, that ecological order. There'll probably be a lot of talk about human ecology in the encyclical. And then the second theme will be the church's traditional concern for the poor and the fact that the bad effects of climate change are likely to dramatically affect poorer nations compared to richer nations, and that richer nations need to sacrifice in order to address those concerns.
410s, just let me give the phone number again, Jeff, in case anyone wants to call and join our conversation here. 410-662-8780 is our number. This is Midday. That was David Cloutier just speaking from Mount St. Mary's University. And now back to Jeff Gutels.
I just want to make a general comment on this, on the whole thing of the ecology, is that within the church, I think there is a growing theology of the environment. But I think it's still in its infancy, and perhaps the encyclical will contribute to that, but it's still at the beginning, I think.
I mentioned David's new book, David Cloutier's book, Walking God's Earth, The Environment and Catholic Faith. So what do you present in this book, David?
Well, the book is divided into two parts. One talks about that theme I just talked about, the importance of recognizing that God has created the world with a certain kind of order, and that we're called to respect that order, work with that grammar of creation, as Benedict XVI called it. And the second part of the book addresses the key patterns in our lives that we should look at and try to change if we're really going to walk on God's earth with respect to the order. So it's very practical. It's really meant for a parish audience, not an audience of other professors like us.
Great. That's great. Well, thank you, David. When we get back, I want to examine a little bit Pope Francis in the digital world and how he's using the media and social media and the whole question of change. Or do we really expect to see change in the culture of the Catholic Church? 410-662-8780 is our phone number. If you'd like to join us, we'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Midday. Okay, so I'm going to read a couple of comments that came in from listeners by email and then pose a question about the Catholic Church and change and whether, and the digital age, this Pope of the digital age, the way he's operating. All right, Evelyn in Dundalk says, until Pope Francis recognizes the equality of women who constitute half the population of Catholics, he can say all he wants against capitalism and in favor of the poor, but he is complicit in keeping women second-class citizens and all that results from that. He has to allow women priests. All right, that's Evelyn from Dundalk. And here's Earl. Earl's comment is, the Pope talks a good game, but the Catholic Church is still actively opposing the use of condoms to combat AIDS. Francis has been quoted as saying that the door is closed on the issue of women's ordination to the priesthood as well. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Okay, so this goes to the question I wanted to pose to Fritz Bauerschmidt today because, you know, very wisely cautioned everybody back when Francis first became Pope and you were here on Midday. It's exciting, but don't expect a whole lot of change very quickly or even maybe in our lifetimes because the Vatican clock is the Vatican clock. But my question is, in the digital age, a pope like this, with this kind of personality and these kinds of priorities, using mainstream media and especially social media to get his message out, can he change things? Does the clock speed up a bit?
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, certainly our expectations have sped up a lot. That's true. And some of that's a cultural shift. But I also think, you know, Francis is a fairly radical shift, at least in papal style. And so I think people quite naturally expect things to change pretty rapidly. But to go back to what we were talking about a second ago on Francis on the environment, I think this notion of an ecology is actually relevant here as well. From all I know about Francis and his history and his biography, he has a strong sense of that the church is an organic reality. It's like an ecology. And one of the things we're learning through climate change is, well, you change one thing and you change everything. And I think that while Francis might recognize that some things need to change in the church, he clearly recognizes that some things need to change in the church. He also recognizes that like any ecology, you have to be careful about the law of unintended consequences. So I think he's going to move towards change. And, you know, I think it's clear on some issues. I think not so clear on other issues. But I think he wants to do it very cautiously, and he wants to do it in a way that's not going to divide the church. I mean, he could tomorrow, theoretically, declare we will have women priests. A large segment of the church would not be ready to go along with that. And I think he wants to bring along as many people as possible.
And it's important to recognize that both the issues your listeners comment on, women priests and contraception, are both issues that the church believes that God has created a certain kind of order. This is the same logic that we were talking about in the environment, and that contraception or ordaining women would be a violation of that order. Now, obviously, we can have debates about whether that is true or not, but the logic of the church's positions here is based on that underlying idea that there is some kind of an order that we need to respect as opposed to
No matter
overturned.
What, no matter
well,
how but, society changes, but, how but, the world changes.
But this is the same debate we have in the environment, right? We're not going to stop driving cars. And so obviously the use of fossil fuels is going to continue. But what is the appropriate use of fossil fuels? Mm-hmm. So what is the appropriate role for various forms of family planning in the church? Mm-hmm. That's a debate.
Or what role should be open
but there is
to
no,
women in the church?
Right.
So for
but
example,
there is no debate. I mean, there would be a debate if Francis were to say, let's have a conversation about this. I don't think he has to declare tomorrow that women shall be ordained. But if he were to say, let's begin the dialogue on this, it may take years, but that would be an accomplishment, I think.
Yeah. I do think it's also important, though, to look at certain things that he has done. So, for example, he named a group to investigate the issue of sexual abuse, which, of course, has been a huge issue,
yeah.
A commission.
Mm-hmm.
He had appointed four lay people to that commission. Three of those four were women. And I think that this commission is a high priority commission for Francis. And I think it's significant that, in a sense, he put as many women as he could on the commission. Now, of course, given the symbolic role of the priest in the liturgy, I think it's natural that people would want to focus on that as the women's issue in the church. But I think short of changing church teaching on that, there's a lot of other things that can be done. There's, to use the ecological metaphor again, there's ways to subtly shift the ecology without doing something drastic that might cause division.
I would add on the Synod on the Family, he also had extensive lay consultation with married couples and particularly with women involved in that process as well.
Jeff?
I am a fan of church history. And I always like to put it in a historical perspective. And in this sense, I think what he is doing is working according to that beautiful Italian saying, festina lente, hurry up slowly. Festina lente. And he is doing that one step at a time with the typical Jesuit discernment. He thinks before he acts. And I think if we had to wait centuries before the church said that charging an interest was not a sin. And I foresee, I don't know if I can make that prediction on the radio here, but I think he will appoint a woman as head of one of the congregations one day, if he lives long enough.
A woman would be head of a congregation?
Of a congregation.
An office in the
Vatican. The Curia.
Of an office
of the Curia.
In the Curia.
Yeah.
Okay. These two emails that came in, Earl and Evelyn, I know many people who could have written these same emails. I've had these same conversations with many of my American Catholic friends, though. Is this the American European view of the church, these questions, these complaints? There is the whole rest of the world. There is Asia that the Pope just visited, and there's South America. And what about that? Is this the American complaint?
Well, I think certainly, while you might find complaints about the role of women in the church, teaching on contraception in the church around the world, I think how those issues get prioritized alongside other things is going to be very different in different places. So I think, for example, in Africa, questions of economic inequality or the relationship between Christianity and Islam, these are going to be much, much more pressing issues, whatever somebody thinks about the role of women or contraception. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite interesting that, at least as far as we can tell, it's in the parts of the world where the population is growing the slowest or even shrinking that you're getting the most calls for the church to approve of contraception, mm-hmm. where clearly people have already made up their own minds about that issue.
Right. You know, speaking, there's a certain logic I wanted to address with David when you were talking about logic before, mm-hmm. and the logic and the theological thinking. Okay, I guess it's possible. What about the logic of not having enough priests? What about the question of using some logic there to address that question?
Well, one of the things that is clearly going to happen in the world church over the next centuries will be more and more lay leadership. I think that Vatican II wanted more lay leadership in the church. And what forms that lay leadership is going to take on are exactly what we're in fact experimenting with in mm-hmm. the American church today. So I think it's important not to attach leadership or power in the church specifically to ordination. Indeed, Francis is trying to get ordained people to see that ordination is not about power. So they need to share power with other people, including lay people. And it may be that that is the route in which men and women, different nations, rich and poor, have a voice in the church through more lay leadership.
And they just have to let priests get married.
Oh, I mean, well, that's another question, the married priesthood.
And Francis has shown a slightly more openness on this. I believe as a bishop from Brazil spoke to Francis about it, you know, is this a possibility? And Francis, in typical Francis style, said, well, go back to Brazil and you bishops start talking about it and come to me with a recommendation. Don't look to me to settle this issue.
Right.
You go back to your local church, talk about your local situation, your local needs, and then you decide what is good for you and come back and then we'll talk.
Well, that's very interesting because that's mm-hmm. hardly top-down directive. That's
not
just the opposite of it.
That is exactly what he is doing. That's what I said in the beginning. The local churches are going to make this kind of decisions from now on.
Something else that's in the same vein. Pope Francis, another gesture I wanted to mention to you. When there's a newly appointed archbishop anywhere in the world, they get a symbol of their office. It's a woolen... what is it,
it's,
Fritz?
It's almost like a necktie.
It's
called
like
a pallium.
A pallium. Yeah. A pallium, okay. So... you're supposed to go to Rome, you're supposed to go to the Vatican to get the pallium. And now the Pope is basically saying, we're going to mail it to you. There's no need for you to come here just for that. Which is, the symbol of that is very interesting to me. It's playing down the trappings of office again, right?
Yeah. And again, also emphasizing the local church. I think probably what's most significant about that is when you receive this, what's most important is... I mean, it's made out of wool, so it's symbolic of the shepherd's clothing, mm-hmm. right? And when you receive your shepherd's clothing, it should be among the sheep you're going to be shepherding, not a select group that can afford to fly to Rome to witness this.
That's the idea. Yeah.
The other thing, this is just a matter of style. We talked about this a little bit earlier. You know, there's the comment he made about rabbits, families having too many children breeding like rabbits. He was, this is on the flight back from the Philippines, and he told the press conference how a woman he knows was pregnant with her eighth child after having the first seven by C-section. He said that is irresponsibility. That woman, he said, some think that in order to be good Catholics, we have to be like rabbits, no responsible parenthood. Okay, and it got him in a little bit of trouble. So it's one of those things, you're just not used to hearing a pope say things like this, right? So this is a matter of style, but people may draw from it this idea that this is a liberalizing pope who's going to make all these changes in the church because of his style.
Well, I think, and I think to get back to a theme that has been consistent in his papacy, I think he wants the church to be a church of mercy. He's used that image of the field hospital, the idea that the church should be out among the people binding up wounds rather than creating more wounds for people. So I don't think that involves necessarily changing substantial church teachings, but it involves not imposing them in a certain way on people.
A couple of days ago, I saw on television Inside the Vatican, a beautiful program, and it was Benedict. And Benedict was celebrating the Mass every day in a small chapel in the Vatican. Francis is celebrating the Mass every day in the chapel of the hotel, together with the sheep. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. That's the difference. And he eats with those people, too.
And he gets his own tray in the food line.
Yeah. That's what I mean. All these are style issues, and they're charming, and they're cool. But
Catholicism is a religion that lives and dies by its symbols. Yeah. So I think in Catholicism, there's never mere style, right? And a particularly savvy pope, I think, recognizes that in some ways you can do more with symbols than you can with teaching, particularly if you want to move people's hearts.
Somebody told me I certainly wouldn't want to be Francis' food taster.
we didn't get into this earlier, but the pope and homosexuality, what have we heard so far? What would you say about that?
I mean, what strikes me about Francis is that he's much more like what I have experienced of, say, parish priests who, without feeling a need to publicly or even privately question official teachings of the church, often interact with homosexual parishioners in very compassionate ways. Now, I don't think that they can always give their homosexual parishioners exactly what they want, which is church approval of their sexuality or their sexual orientation or of their relationships. If I've got a second,
about a minute.
Okay, a former pastor of mine, when he was a seminarian, worked in a prison, and he said that what the prisoners wanted most was they wanted to be out of prison. And he said that what he realized quickly was that that he had to let them know, I can't give you that. I can't give you the thing you want most. But given that I can't give you that, what can we do? And he said this explicitly in the context of ministering to homosexual parishioners. I can't bless your relationship.
Right.
I can't marry you.
Right.
That might be what you want most. But given that I can't give you that, what can I do for you?
And that's what you're hearing from
and
Francis.
And that's what I hear from Francis.
That's great. Fritz, thank you very much for being here again. Fritz Bauerschmidt is chair of the Department of Theology at Loyola University, Maryland. He's also a deacon assigned to Corpus Christi Parish in Baltimore, and he blogs at Pray Tell, right? And you can find a link to that blog on my Facebook page. David Cloutier writes quite a bit, too. He writes for Catholic Moral Theology. You can find his posts linked to the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. David is an associate professor of theology at Mount St. Mary's University. He has a new book out called Walking God's Earth, The Environment and Catholic Faith, published by Liturgical Press. David, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, I always appreciate having you on the show. And Jeff Goetels,
Nice to have you back on the show again, Gutels.
Gutels, yes.
Gutels, nice to have you back. Jeff's first book was I Really Never Left, about his priesthood and all his years teaching here at Notre Dame Prep, and a new book now called Holy White Smoke, The Second Vatican Council Under Siege, a novel. It's on Amazon. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
Midday continues in a moment here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Then stay with us this afternoon at 2 for Here and Now.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. When you think of food that's easy to cook at home, Indian probably doesn't make the list. But chef Anupi Singla says it's a lot simpler than you think.
Unlike cuisines like French and other Western cuisines, it's not about the slicing and dicing, it's about the spices.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now. Catch it this afternoon at 2 here on your public radio. Stay tuned at 3 for Fresh Air, and then at 4 o'clock for All Things Considered.
The United States continues to strongly support Ukraine's territorial integrity.
The U.S. also accuses Russia of arming Ukrainian separatists.
Tanks, heavy weapons, rockets. This needs to stop.
The Secretary of State travels to Kiev as Washington considers supplying weapons to Ukraine. That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, you can hear it this afternoon from 4 until 6:30. Stay tuned at 6:30 for business news on Marketplace, then stick around tonight at 7 for The World.
I'm Marco Werman. Linguists have learned that the way we use and is evolving. And the same change is happening in other languages.
German.
Das,
Danish. Dutch.
And we eat hort. That is for.
And Norwegian.
Den sost du del I.
What and tell us about the future of language. That story, right here on The World.
And you can hear The World tonight at 7 here on your public radio. Member support at 88.1 WYPR. Temperatures in the mid-20s this afternoon. Lows in the lower teens in Baltimore tonight. Outside the city could get down into the single digits. This is WYPR and WYPR HD1 Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, and WYPO Ocean City. Your NPR news station. It's 1 o'clock.
What matters more, where you live or where you work? Surveys suggest that young Americans, the millennials who represent nearly half of the country's workforce, are moving toward cities as much for the social life and the sense of belonging as for work. They also place high value on community service. Sense of place and the power of place in our lives is the subject of the next hour of Midday. Our culture commentator Sherry Parks joins us, along with Catherine Laughlin. She studies placemaking and the human attachment to cities. We'll also meet Melanie Douglas, creator of an upcoming pop-up event that encourages people to express their love for Baltimore, why they live here, what makes them stay, at a laundromat. Power of Place on Midday after the news.